time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Arun Gupta. Arun Gupta is an independent journalist and regular contributor to the UK Guardian, In These Times, The Progressive, and Truth Out. And he is co-founder of the Occupied Wall Street Journal and a founding editor of the award-winning grassroots New York City newspaper, The Independent. Arun, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us again this morning.
Great to be with you today, Mike.
So let's start out. You have just printed last night, hot off the press, article in These Times, mm-hmm. regarding Seattle's recent developments with the $15 an hour wage, minimum wage. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So last week, Mayor Ed Murray announced a proposal. He had set up this Income Inequality Advisory Committee in December. Basically, we can say as a result of the election of Shama Sawant, who a socialist who ran on a platform of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour immediately. So he set up this commission of 24 people handpicked, mainly business folk. About 12 of them are business people, 3 city council members, some labor leaders, nonprofit, and so on. And so they'd been supposedly debating this idea for months, and they finally came up with an agreement. So this is just a plan. There's all sorts of headlines like Seattle is now has the highest minimum wage. No, it has nothing of the sort. This is just a proposal that will now be submitted to the city council. And it's a very complicated proposal. And I think that's one thing that is important to hone in on. The basics of it are it creates all these schedules like Uncle Sam does. So workers and employers now have to figure out under which schedule they fall under. So there's two important definitions. What is a big business or a small business? A small business is defined as having 500 employees or less, and that's nationwide. That covers 99% of all businesses in Seattle. It covers 70% of all full-time workers. Supposedly, according to one source I talked to, the big business definition, over 500 workers, does cover two-thirds of low-wage workers, low-income workers. So this is McDonald's, Pizza Hut, Target, things like that. Then the other category is if workers receive health care and or if they receive tips. And so you have all these different schedules about, you know, when the wages will go up when. So the upshot is if you work at McDonald's and they do not provide health care, your wages will go up under the plan, will go up to $15 an hour on January 1st, 2017. And, of course, the question is, why does McDonald's have to wait 3 years? Or rather, why do the workers have to wait 3 years? This is a corporation that made $5.5 billion in its global operations last year. Vastly wealthy corporation and whose CEO is paid many millions of dollars a year. Or Starbucks, whose CEO is paid $9,600 an hour. Why do Starbucks workers continue to have to live in poverty for all this time? Now then, for a small business, it could take up to 7 years. And this is just under the proposal, right? This has to go through the legislative meat grinder that is the city council. And, of course, we'll see all sorts of business interests weighing in. And the word from members on the mayor's advisory committee is like, well, this is, you know, the price of getting buy-in from basically everyone, and they needed to get a supermajority. 21 of 24 members reportedly approved the deal. A couple of business interests did not sign off on the deal. And the other person who did not approve the deal was Shama Sawant, who her description of it, I think, is an accurate one. She said this is a step forward. You know, this will improve the lives of the working class. And we should, you know, be proud of that, particularly because this would not have happened without her campaign, without the $15 now, movement, without the role of Socialist Alternative, the party of which she's a leader, the thousands of people, that 15 now has mobilized. But at the same time, you know, the political and business establishment are trying to water it down as much as possible. And this is overly complicated because it, I think it then makes enforcement hard. People's eyes start to glaze over trying to figure it all out. It took me a couple of days, to really understand, how it's supposed to work. And I think in, some ways that, what they're potentially doing is opening the door to wage theft. Because of, the difficulty of figuring out the schedules in terms of if they have this thing called guaranteed minimum compensation. So if you're a worker in a small business and you're getting health care and say, you know, you're a barista and you're getting tips, you're supposed to get a certain guaranteed minimum wage according to one schedule, but then you're supposed to be getting a guaranteed minimum compensation according to another schedule. And so I think it can just lead to all sorts of shenanigans. And in fact, we have seen this. This has become an issue both in Seattle and nationwide, wage theft, and especially in the fast food industry. And when you think about it, these are some of the largest corporations in the world, McDonald's, Burger King, Domino's. And according to various reports out there, there is just systematic and pervasive wage theft. There was one study commissioned by labor organizations in New York City, but it was a the study was carried out independently. It was a survey of 500 fast food workers. This is just last year, and it found 84% of them reported some form of wage theft. And it counted seven different, some workers were subjected to seven different types of wage theft. So that can be everything from working off the clock to being forced to clock out early or come in early to being forced to pay for uniforms or transportation that you're not supposed to be. And this is how, you know, these fortunes are built. And so for businesses, they'll have incentives. And, you know, like one of the questions I had is just like, well, you know, if I'm a Burger King manager, why don't I just now put out a tip jar for employees? And so this now counts towards their guaranteed minimum compensation. And I can, you know, lie and say what exactly they're getting in the tip jar. Or, you know, it could lead, to, business owners or managers, stealing tips. You know, they can be like, well, you're making the guaranteed minimum now, so I'm going to take everything above that. And, one person I talked to is just like, well, that's illegal. That's a felony. Well, so what? You know, it's also illegal to fire, workers during union drives. And by some estimates, over tens of thousands of workers are fired every year for, legally protected union activity. The point is not whether it's legal or illegal. It has to do with enforcement. And there's talk about, oh, we're going to have these great enforcement mechanisms. But I don't buy it because, you know, there's essentially, I think it was either Howard Zinn or I.F. Stone who said, you know, the first rule about reporting on government is governments lie. And we can also say that about corporations. Corporations lie. And, you know, going a little further afield, Seattle is obviously a huge tech city. In the news for the last couple of months now, a lot of people haven't really seen it. The mainstream media has only picked up on it in the last week. This huge wage fixing scandal with Apple and then Steve Jobs. So over the last decade before he died, he basically forced these agreements with other tech giants like Google, Intuit, Adobe, and was shooting off these emails telling them, if you try to poach our employees, or rather hire our employees, which is perfectly legal, we're going to go to war, and essentially raid your company. And by some estimates, you know, this involved, well over 100,000 engineers, in the tech industry, and the amount of stolen wages, and I think this is probably a severe underestimate because we don't really know how many people were involved, was something like $8.7 billion. Okay, so here, if we have the most admired, wealthiest corporations in the world are systematically stealing wages from upper middle class professionals, you know, how often do you think this happens at the lower end of the economic spectrum? And the fact of the matter is it is absolutely systematic. It's how Walmart began. Walmart's model back in the 1960s, I did a big report on the Walmart working class that was published in Registering Class. This is an there's this book that's put out every year called The Socialist Register. This year is the 50th anniversary, and the title is Registering Class because it's a look at how class is constructed today and also lives. So I kind of did this sociological overview of the Walmart working class. And Sam Walton, in the beginning when he founded Walmart, what he did was he created all these dummy corporations, all these shell corporations to evade federal minimum wage laws. So from the beginning, Walmart's model was wage theft. At one point, about 10, 15 years ago, Walmart settled about 70 different class action wage theft lawsuits for $500 million. You know, this just becomes a cost of doing business. You just steal the wages, and if you get caught, you know, you pay some lawyers and you pay a small fee, but in the end, you're walking away with much more money than if you had to pay the proper wages. So I think there's a lot of serious questions. You know, I think, you know, this should be something that, is seen as a victory that the grassroots forced upon the political and business establishment in Seattle. But at the same time, they were forced to do it. They are trying to water it down. It's not a done deal. This still has to go through the legislative process where it can be weakened all sorts of ways, where there can be more loopholes in it. And the fact of the matter is I think there's also a danger in having this really long-term schedule that it takes 7 years to get to $15 an hour, and the minimum compensation is not phased out for 11 years until 2025. And we will see business interests come in, whether, you know, that's the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, whether it's the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, which is the Koch brothers outfit, or, you know, ALEC, American Legislative, I forget exactly what ALEC stands for, but it's basically the body that rewrites state laws. We'll see them come in, almost guaranteed, and try and overturn this, try and weaken it in some way. So the battle, I think, is really just begun on this, but I think it is a hopeful sign that shows, you know, what can be done by a very focused and relentless grassroots mobilization.
I believe in your article you mentioned that Seattle had recently passed a wage theft law, and what's been the results of that?
In 2011, it passed an ordinance criminalizing wage theft. Last summer, while a lot of this fast food organizing, there's been this big fast food organizing campaign that the Service Employees International Union kicked off a couple of years ago, and so they've been trying to organize workers with two demands, $15 an hour and a union. This is also something that was a significant, I think, impact and influence on the Seattle campaign. So in 2011, Seattle passes this ordinance, and it's something that the police are supposed to enforce. And last summer there were hearings about this. And all these workers came before the city council and were giving details about just systematic and perversive wage theft in the fast food industry, and there hadn't been one prosecution in this whole time. I'm not sure if there's been one since then, but still, that's rather appalling. You know, if I go into a liquor store, or if I break into someone's house when they're not home and know that they're not home, because, you know, I don't want to have any chance of hurting someone, and, you know, steal their money, steal valuables, I'm going to go to jail for years, perhaps decades, if I'm caught. And yet corporations can freely steal from their workers, and no one's trying to prosecute them. I mean, it shows really where power lies, and also it shows our conception of what crime is and isn't.
So would it be our city attorney who would be responsible for prosecuting those cases?
Yeah, I imagine so. And the police are supposed to take complaints. And, you know, I'm trying to remember, I think it might have been the stranger that had some funny kind of anecdotes about contacting the police department and about wage theft. And the police were basically like, we don't know anything about this. We're not responsible for this, when actually they are responsible for it. Though I don't think you really want the cops, and it's just like, and how are the cops going to be watching this anyway? You know, when wage theft is things like someone at McDonald's, being forced to work off the clock at 1 a.m. You know, who are they going to call? How are they going to get someone in there? And, you know, a lot of it has to do with the fact that the workers don't want to raise a ruckus because they're on the edge economically. They don't want to lose the job, and they're afraid, or they may be undocumented, and so they work off, they do whatever the boss tells them.
So labor was involved in the local negotiating for Murray's announcement. What is your take on labor's role in all of this?
I think that this is a deal that is problematic. I think that it's a deal that needs to be made stronger. But I talked to one of the local labor leaders, David Rolfe, and he's head of SEIU, a healthcare union in the area, and he said he expects this that this has to pass as is, with very few modifications, if any, because labor and business both signed off on it. I don't know the particulars of the various unions here, but what I do know, for instance, is, as I mentioned, SEIU has been behind the fast food organizing around the nation. And that's a great thing, you know, to see fast food workers on the move. But it's a campaign that's fraught with a lot of problems. It's very much a top-down movement where workers have very little control. There's been activity in Seattle. There was some walkouts last May, but I've talked to I interviewed about five different workers and organizers in Seattle who told me stories about how the SEIU organizers themselves were being mistreated by the union, to the point that the fast food workers they were organizing were planning to hold a protest in support of the SEIU staff to protest the poor working conditions that they were under. And this has also gone on in other cities. Apparently, in New York City, the fast food workers, organizers, the SEIU staff, the ones who are organizing the fast food workers, have filed to form a union because they were being mistreated. Essentially, they work 50-hour weeks. When they ramp up for these regular actions, there's going to be a day of action coming up on May 15th. This one is going to be international, but there'll also be protests by fast food workers around the country. Organizers were telling me they'd have to work 70 to 80-hour weeks, and yet they're getting paid maybe about $35,000 a year. And when they did the calculation, they were being paid well under $15 an hour. And so in New York City, they apparently filed for a union election. I talked to organizers in Chicago, SEIU. Again, these are the ones who are organizing the fast food workers, who they also tried to form a staff union, but they claimed that it was busted by SEIU. So, you know, it's problematic. You know, I think certainly corporations have a vast amount of power and wealth. You know, unions do have a lot of resources, but I think a way of putting it in perspective is all the money that unions have at their disposal, that they get in dues are, less, than what, Wall Street, bankers get in bonuses in any given year. And, you know, Wall Street banks are just one sector of the economy. So they're going up against the Fortune 500, who have 100 times more money than them. So there is no such thing as a level playing field when it comes to union organizing in this country. But at the same time, I think a lot of the big unions have a very problematic structure and relationship. They're not really interested in rank and file democracy. They're not really, they do not want any sort of militancy. They signed these very complicated agreements. You know, there's a story from the 1930s about when, after the United Auto Workers, first unionized, their contract was, so just basic, it fit on a business card, a little 3x5 business card. That was their entire contract. And workers, would take out, the card and flash it to the management on the line, basically saying, you know, it was their way of saying to them, you know, you can't do this to us because here's our contract. And it's no longer like that. You know, when you have these overly complicated agreements, what it does is it disempowers the workers, and people will often blame unions for having all these rules. And it's just like, no, it's the corporations who want all these rules, because if they're forced to recognize a union, they want these highly complicated contracts, because every rule is a chance to take something back. It's a chance to force more time onto the workers. It's a chance to get the workers to pay more towards health care or towards training, or, you know, it's a chance to create different tiers of wages. I was in Portland recently and covered the organizing around the public school teachers there, and they successfully beat back a terrible contract from the city. And it was just the contract. I mean, these things are just so hard to understand. And I'm not a lawyer, but I know how to read legal contracts. And what it amounted to was something like 75 different givebacks that the city of Portland was demanding from the teachers. And it's just all these minute things, because it's just a way to disempower the workers. Teachers are workers, of course. It's a way to, you know, you force them to pay more for health care, you force more time on them, that they would have to, you know, do more prep time, they had less control over their job. They're essentially being treated as drones. And the teachers staged a very successful community organizing campaign because the contract and the school system in Portland was also very much an attack on quality public education. But it, you know, it becomes hard to mobilize your membership around these things because the contracts are extremely difficult to understand. And so with Seattle, with this $15 an hour, proposal that has four different wage schedules, that has this minimum compensation where you're going to have all these calculations and enforcement and, you know, does this health plan, you know, qualify or not? What happens if For a health plan to be considered minimum compensation, it has to be at least silver level under the Affordable Care Act. But what if a business, you know, suddenly cuts health care? What happens to those workers' wages? Do they shift schedules? Or what if a business adds health care? Does it suddenly also shift? So, you know, you're just, I think, really opening the door to all sorts of shenanigans that corporations will engage in with these complicated schedules.
So it seems like the one type of union structure that does really well with cities consistently is police unions. They don't seem to run into these problems that, as you just gave the example of with the teachers' union.
Yeah, police unions are unique. Police unions, you know, correction officers, like for decades, the prison building boom in California was being driven by the correction officers unions because they were spending huge sums of money lobbying the state to build more prisons. It got to the point, I'm not sure what the present statistics are because they've had to scale back the prison building due to the economic crisis, but it got to the point where California was spending more on prisons than it was on higher education. And, you know, remember, California, at least at one point, had one of the greatest higher education systems in the Western world. And yet here they are spending more locking people up than educating them. It's appalling. And yeah, you know, if you want to talk about just ridiculous contracts, it's the police unions, you know, who get these contracts where if you're a cop and you make it 5 years, essentially your salary really starts to escalate, but it's the pensions that start to become really absurd. Like, I know that in New York City, where I live, a police officer's pension. Now, if you get a pension in almost any job, it's basically about your income over the whole lifetime of your tenure, whether you've worked there 20, 25, 30 years. But in New York City, if you're a cop, your pension is based on the last year that you work, solely on that. And so there's this incentive, and this is what the cops do in the last year, their 20th year, is they will just pile on the overtime, just work as much as possible. And they'll have these six-figure salaries in their last year, and they get something like 60%. And so they'll be retired in their early 40s with, you know, a $50,000-$60,000 income for life and just the highest level health care. And, you know, they'll just continue to draw on this potentially for 40 or 50 years. You know, the costs are absolutely enormous. But let's also not forget, you know, during Occupy Wall Street, there was just the cops were literally protecting the banks. And it came out also that the big investment banks like Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan were directly giving millions of dollars to the New York City Police Department every year. And so, you know, the cops are essentially a private force to protect the finance industry and Wall Street.
Well, with that, we are just about out of time. We're talking with Arun Gupta. He is the founding editor of The Independent Magazine and founding editor of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. And you are speaking in town Monday night.
Yep. Right? Elliott Bay Books, along with Steve Early, one of the best labor reporters in the country. And we're going to be talking about basically the workers' movements and the state of organized labor and, you know, just what's going on in this country economically because we're still in the seventh year of this economic crisis. The rich are making off like bandits, but for the 99% of Americans, their real income has dropped, the household income is dropped, and it's hard times for a lot of people. So we're talking about the perils and possibilities of worker organizing in America today.
All right. And what time does that start?
7 p.m.
Okay, great. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us again this morning.
Thanks for having me, Mike.